It is a great pleasure to welcome to the program once again David Cannadine, who is a noted British historian, though he has extended his historical range from studies of many eminent British figures and of great surges and movements in British life from the 19th century to the present moment. He's extended that range now to the study of a major American figure and a great biographical work that person being biographized as Andrew Mellon. The title of the book is, quite directly and appropriately, Mellon, An American Life. In what sense is it an American life rather than just a life at the higher reaches of the financial aristocracy?
Well, it's an American life because Mellon was part of a group of figures who all belonged to the same generation, such as Frick and Rockefeller. Mm. And Hearst and Morgan, who are all operating from the late 19th to the early 20th century, and some of them on into the 1920s. And it's an era of freewheeling, buccaneering capitalism. And to their enemies, these were the robber barons, people of no business morality, who hated the workers and ground down the poor. But to themselves, they were great constructive entrepreneurial figures, building up the economic strength of the country, that's to say America, and by virtue of doing that, providing lots of jobs from which ordinary people benefited. So I think Mellon belonged to that specific phase of American capitalism, and that's the sense, I think, in which it is specifically an American life. I ought to say that my publishers thought long and hard about what title this book ought to have. And their original idea was that it should be modeled on Ron Chernow's biography of Rockefeller, and that was called Titan, colon, The Life of Rockefeller. And they wanted to know what my equivalent of that would be, and I suggested Boring, colon, The Life of Andrew Mellon, because Andrew Mellon, though an interesting man, was actually a rather dull man in some ways, but not unreasonably, they didn't think this would appeal to the marketing people. So it ended up as Mellon, An American Life.
Well, the personal side of the story, if not boring, at least is in considerable sense empty, isn't it?
Yes, it's empty and sad. Mellon was a figure who was absolutely brilliant at men and business and all of that, but whose personal life, emotional life, was very fenced in and cold and distant. He was personally very shy and secretive. His marriage to a woman less than half his age.
He was 43 and she was 18.
That's right. And it was not a success. She was English. She loved the English countryside. He urges her to come to Pittsburgh. They go to Pittsburgh. She can't stand Pittsburgh.
That scene where you have them getting off the train and she's astonished. She says, this isn't the place we're going, is it?
You don't mean to say we live here?
That's
her question.
The words, yes.
As they chug into polluted, fog-encrusted Pittsburgh.
As the soot covers her.
Exactly so. Yeah. And that's a sort of disaster. And she falls in love with somebody else, perhaps not surprisingly. There are two children, but then there's a very acrimonious divorce case. And after that, there don't seem to have been any serious women, as far as one can tell. There may have been, but there's no evidence for it in Mellon's life. His relations with his children are very distant. And he was always, in that sense, a rather sad and silent and solitary man.
We'll come back to his personal life in a moment, because it is a fascinating personal life, if only for its bleakness. Mm. But with regard to the public life and the public career, at his peak, how much of America did he own or control?
Well, he never owned a sort of disproportionate amount. He was extremely rich at his peak. In our terms, he was certainly a billionaire by the 1910s or 1920s. But it was a rather unusual fortune compared to Rockefeller or Frick or Carnegie or Morgan, in that it wasn't just associated with one single industry, as those people tended to be. Mellon's portfolio of interests was very broad. It was coal, iron, railroads up to a point, steel up to a point. It was also aluminum, Alcoa, chemicals and oil, above all Gulf oil. So it was spread across a lot of different industries. And very few of them, if any, had the Mellon name attached. So it was a diverse, but in some ways rather invisible fortune.
Goodness, you have been Americanized. You're a Brit, obviously, but you served, I know, in a professorship at Columbia for 10 years before you went back to the University of London. But you just said aluminum rather than aluminium.
Well, I do say that because that's how it's spelled here.
That's right.
And that's what Mellon did. So I
practiced
hard.
But in England, you do say aluminium.
You do, but I practiced hard to get it right for here.
Well, the book is written in a fine American accent, in a way. You've got a feeling for these people and for their time and for their manners. And, of course, also you have studied the financial or the business aristocracy in this country and the landed or otherwise ennobled aristocracy of Great Britain. You've got a book done a few years earlier titled The Decline and Fall of the British Aristocracy. What a falling off was there. How did it happen? And how does it compare to the fate of these great hierarchs of the corporate world?
Well, the book I wrote on the British aristocracy tried to explain. It was written in the 1990s, and it was published indeed the week that Thatcher fell from power. And it tried to explain how Britain had moved across the 20th century from being a world kind of owned and run and dominated by a limited group of, on the whole, titled landowners, to Margaret Thatcher's world and subsequently John Major's world, where the people who ran the show were people like them who were not at all aristocratic in their background. And I tried to track that. And one of the elements of that, as certain members of the aristocracy became poorer, was, of course, that they sold off their pictures along with lots of other things. And so that connects a bit with Mellon's world, because Mellon was one of those rich Americans on the way up who was buying, especially in the 1920s and 30s, the sort of pictures that poor aristocrats on the way down were selling off.
As mediated by two particular dealers.
That's right. One of them was Nodlers and Company, famous dealer established in the middle of the 19th century in New York, still in being in New York to this day. The second one, this remarkable figure who perks up the narrative at various points, Joseph Jeveen, who was a hugely flamboyant and many people thought rather suspect seller of pictures. Andrew Mellon himself said pictures never looked as good as when Jeveen was standing in front of
them. Didn't he end as Lord Jeveen?
He ended up as Lord Jeveen. He was terribly grand. He was a trustee of the National Gallery in London and of the National Portrait Gallery and of the Tate. And he, more than anybody, talked up, in a way, the international art market in the 1920s and 30s.
But, you know, as you talk of the changing of the aristocratic guard, so to speak, in England, and as we think of these high figures of corporate finance who might still properly be classified as robber barons, though they run into the 1930s and thereabouts, but both of those groups have been replaced, to be sure, by others coming from other sectors of society. A new aristocracy's rise. And it brings to mind the general thesis of the work of Vilfredo Pareto in his best-known volume, The Circulation of Elites. Is it the case that in all societies, everywhere, anytime, or is it only in the Western democratic societies that elites are usually shuffled off the stage after a few decades of prominence?
I don't know, but one of the things that certainly strikes a British observer of America, as I have been for the best part of a third of a century, that's to say not merely observing it but coming here and loving being here, is that hereditary politics is still practiced in this country in a way that isn't true in Britain. Mm-hmm. That's to say that there are dynasties of Bushes and Gores and several others still around where across the generations a family seems to have some claim on the electorate's notice and on the legislature's attention. And it's very difficult. In fact, I think it's probably impossible to produce any English equivalents of that.
The Pitts.
But that's some time
ago.
We haven't been in the pits, or at least not in that sense, for several centuries. So what strikes a British observer of America is that it's actually, in many ways, still an 18th century political world, whereas in Britain, actually, it isn't any longer like that.
But with regard to mere riches and social preferment, we've had a very significant circulation of elites in this country. The new billionaires don't come from the old families of the Rockefellers or the Mellons.
Yes, that's certainly true. And obviously, Bill Gates is a newly circulating elite of one, if one can put it that way. And certainly, one of the things that is interesting to see is how shifts in the economy and in technology, especially the world of IT, have spawned and generated a whole new array of fortunes held and created by people from completely different backgrounds from those who've gone before.
So here we are talking about history and great surging movements in history, and also about individuals who ride the currents of history or may shift the currents of history in directions which would not have been taken but for their presence, which raises, of course, the great Carlylean question of whether history is and the Churchillian view that history is nothing more than the record of the doings of great historical actors, or conversely, Marx and others long before him argue that history follows certain inevitable courses of conflict or of thesis versus antithesis. Social forces clash, and individuals ride the crest of those of the waves of those clashes. My metaphors are getting a little bit out of control. When we return, after we do our bit to shore up capitalism in the present American corporate form, I do want to talk with you about your basic philosophy of history. And are you, in any sense, either Marxian or Carlylean with regard to the question of the individual in history? We return to David Cannadine directly after we pause for this. And we return to David Cannadine. We have been drawing from and will return to his new book, Mellon, An American Life. That is, by the way, just published by Alfred A. Knopf and Company. But I was raising the general question of how one goes at history, and indeed, what is the dynamic of history? I offer you this quotation from an English political figure, not unknown to you, Benjamin Disraeli, who says, "Read no history, nothing but biography, for that is life without theory." I think he was a Carlylean.
Well, I think Disraeli had a vested interest in believing that great men made history and hoping that he would get aboard that bandwagon, yeah. Which I think he probably did. It's all very complicated, which is a kind of rather feeble answer, but it's not, I think, erroneous. I think that I've certainly written in The Decline and Fall of the British Aristocracy about trying to trace large-scale, long-term social trends, mm-hmm. which up to a point it's possible to do. But in any such narrative, individuals stand out either as examples or as counterexamples. And I suppose having come to write the life of one particular individual in this book on Mellon, I've both been concerned to evoke his significance and achievements as an individual and his personality to the extent that he had one, but also to place him in a broader context. It's quite interesting that one of his friends, Frick, says at some point there was enormously important work to be doing, by which he means the economic transformation of America in the late 19th century. If we hadn't done it, other people would. And I think one needs to get that sense that while Mellon and Frick and their cohort were as individuals significant, they are both the agents, beneficiaries of a set of trends.
So they are carried by the tide of history.
To some degree, yeah. I think they
are enacting something which would have otherwise been enacted by others.
I think that's right.
But I love to play with counterfactuals in this regard, and one very obvious one is this, for example. I've used it before on the air, and even in some stuff I've written. Imagine a scene in 1918. A wounded German soldier is being helped to the rear by two colleagues, and a bomb falls right on top of them, and all three of them are killed. The man in the middle is Hitler. What would the difference would that have made for the rest of European history?
Well, it's interesting that A.J.P. Taylor, in his Course of German History, once famously described Adolf Hitler as the unknown soldier of the First World War, but unhappily not yet buried, which catches rather well the sense that things might have been different. I think that one has to recognize that accident and contingency are important. They're not always important.
Can we imagine the genocide having happened if Hitler had been killed in World War I?
I think we could imagine it happening. Whether it would have happened, I don't know. I mean, by the same token, Churchill might have been deselected as MP for his constituency, which didn't like what he was doing about appeasement. And it's not inconceivable that Churchill would not have been an MP in 1940. Would Britain have survived in 1940 without Churchill? Don't know.
Quite possibly not.
Quite possibly not.
Yeah.
So it's important to be reminded that individuals do matter. And in certain circumstances, they may matter so much that there wouldn't have been somebody else who could have done it for them. But I think in the Mellon, Frick, Carnegie, Rockefeller world, if one or other of them hadn't have appeared, somebody else would. So that it's not quite the same comparison.
Well, coming back to Mellon, he was in fact carrying forward an operation begun by his very significant father.
Yes, like many very rich people, it's not a rags-to-riches story. It's a riches-to-super-riches story. The father, Thomas Mellon, who I have to say I found a very interesting figure, in some ways a more interesting figure than Mellon, though not as significant a figure. Thomas Mellon was a self-made man. He was born in Northern Ireland, comes over to Western Pennsylvania with his parents. They're farmers. Thomas decides he wants to reject that agricultural upbringing, trains as a lawyer, is a successful lawyer, gets into real estate, coal mining, and a whole set of things, and makes a lot of money.
Serves as a judge for just a little while.
Serves as a judge.
And is called judge for the rest of his life.
That's right. Makes a lot of money and wants his sons to carry on as businessmen like him. And whereas he rebelled against his father, he's pretty determined his children won't rebel against him. And one of the things he does to help set his sons up in business is to found this bank, Thomas Mellon and Sons, in 1869. And it's that private bank eventually which Andrew Mellon comes to manage and to transform, and it's that bank and the management and transformation of that bank by Andrew Mellon which is the basis of his great success as a businessman.
I gather the basic gimmick that they use is if they had to make a major loan to some rising company, they would usually demand some stock or a seat on the board.
Well, I suppose one could call it a gimmick, but what
a mechanism.
The mechanism that Mellon, Andrew Mellon, devises is that bright young people, he gets a reputation as being a man who is sympathetic to bright young people with clever ideas of great business potential, e.g. Coppers, Alcoa, Carborundum. And bright young people with these ideas come to him, he lends them money, the companies grow, he takes shares in the companies, a seat on the board, and as those companies grow, he becomes more prosperous. So he is, in a way, an early example of what we now call a venture capitalist.
Exactly so.
Yeah. And he was astonishingly successful at that. And he's the right man in the right place at the right time. This is Western Pennsylvania in the late 19th, early 20th century, where everything's prospering.
He had four or five other brothers.
That's right.
And one of them, at least, was rather a close partner in the enterprise.
He's one of eight children. Only four survived to adulthood. He's the sixth child. And his younger brother, Richard B. Mellon, Dick Mellon, is, in a sense, his business partner. And most of the businesses they do together, though it's generally thought that Andrew was much the cleverer and the more imaginative of the two.
And yet, again, that personal life is so bleak. Much of that appears in the wonderful narrative that you've given us. Up until the time he married, he lived in the same house as did his father.
It's a very stern upbringing he has. They're Presbyterians. They're
Scotch-Irish.
Scotch-Irish Presbyterians. They don't laugh much. They're not people to make a party go. It's a world in which the guiding motto of life is acquisition and accumulation. And in that household, Mellon lives until he's 45.
Acquisition and accumulation, but don't take any great pleasure from it.
That's right. I think that
they're very much out of Weber's the Protestant ethic, aren't they?
They are very much out of Weber's the Protestant ethic. There is this huge interest in making lots of money. Though I think it's fair to say in Andrew Mellon's case that the interest wasn't in simply having lots of money. The interest was in creating companies and growing companies. Mellon didn't ever know how rich he was. He didn't live an ostentatious life. He didn't make money to have it to spend. He liked making companies grow. There was a sense in which he was a genuinely creative figure. He was fascinated by aluminum, by oil, by a whole variety of new technologies. And he saw himself as an enabler and as a facilitator. He once said, real success comes from making other people successful. And that was his self-image. And like most self-images, it wasn't wholly true, but it certainly wasn't wholly false either.
I can't resist being, by training a psychologist, I can't resist raising sort of the voyeuristic psychological question. He didn't marry till 43. Did he have any kind of romantic life at all before then?
There are two romantic liaisons in the 1880s with a woman called Fanny Jones, who dies of consumption, and a woman called Minnie Caldwell, who goes to Kansas. How intense or close those liaisons were, I don't know. Mellon certainly went to Europe in the 1880s with his friend Henry Clay Frick, and I think they met women in Europe. What, if anything, Andrew did with those women, I just don't know. So it's impossible to know Andrew's state of, as it were, sexual and emotional experience when he married Nora Mellon.
You conceive the possibility that he married as a virgin, so to speak?
I think that's not inconceivable.
How curious.
But I don't know.
Yeah.
And I think it's impossible to know. I don't think there's any doubt that she was, and I should think it is not inconceivable that he was, though it's less likely that he was than that she was.
A wonderful aspect of all of this, just staying again with the voyeuristic personal side, but you do develop this quite fully in the book, as well as developing much else concerning the general relation of Mellon to a major movement in American history and in American economic development. But there is the strange marriage. It ends in divorce, as you say, but then he tries to remarry her.
It is very strange that there's this hugely acrimonious divorce between 1910 and 1912, which upsets everybody really forever, including the two children. Whether there were then any other women in Mellon's life, I don't know. I have a half suspicion there might have been, but I certainly can't prove that. And certainly later on, he says that the portraits of beautiful English women are the only women in his life, which is what Paul Mellon thought about his father. But then in the early 1920s, he does ask Nora to marry him again. You'd have thought once round with Nora would have been quite enough.
That's when she's finished the second marriage, I think.
No, it's when she's about to start the second marriage.
Yes.
And the reason she won't marry Andrew is because she's about to marry somebody else.
But then that one ends in divorce for her.
And that one ends in divorce for her. And then there are constant rumours that he and Nora will get together again. They never do, but they do become in the end good friends.
And you tell us that at the very end she proposed that they do renew their marriage.
That's right. But by then,
he was 79 or thereabouts.
Yeah, and I think he feels by then that enough has been enough. So it is a very strange story.
I said to you before we went on the air that in some ways this almost sounds like a, a Jamesian narrative, Henry James or Edith Wharton novel.
I think that's right. I think Andrew Mellon could have stepped straight from the pages of Henry James or Edith Wharton into this transatlantic world of business, yeah. pictures, art, love, betrayal, all that. And Andrew is entirely, in many ways, a creature of that world. He's also there's also a bit of Scott Fitzgerald and a bit of Dos Passos yes. later, but that's slightly different.
We pause just briefly and to the newsroom for an update on what's been happening from Steve Ruxton. And we return to David Cannadine, drawing from, but we cannot possibly do full justice to, the rich content superbly presented with great literary flair, as well as undoubtedly with significant historical accuracy of, I've lost the subject of my sentence, but the reference is to the book Mellon, An American Life, just published by Alfred A. Knopf and Company. We haven't yet talked about his public life. Of course, he was a public figure as the great corporate organizer and banker that he was, but he then enters into the cabinet. He's brought in by President Harding, for whom he had little regard, apparently.
That's right. Mellon once said that he wouldn't have given Harding a middle management job in one of his companies.
Yes.
But that didn't mean he couldn't be President of the United States, I suppose. Mellon was Secretary of the Treasury from 1921 to 1932. And then
it's a long run.
It's a very long run. It was said that three presidents served under him. And when things were going well, he was acclaimed as the greatest Secretary of the Treasury since Alexander Hamilton. The presidents being, of course, Harding and then Coolidge.
Of course, he was the Secretary of the Treasury in boom times.
He was the Secretary of the Treasury in very booming times, the Roaring Twenties, up until the Wall Street crash of 29. He reduced taxes. He reduced the national debt. He enforced prohibition, which is what he had to do. And he fixed in part the revival of the international economy. So there was some case for saying that he was, up to a point at least, the architect of the Roaring Twenties. The problem then, of course, is that from 29 to 32, it all goes very badly wrong. The Great Crash, the Great Depression, all that occurs on his watch. And Mellon, having been perhaps overpraised as the man who delivered prosperity, then became denounced as the man who had been responsible for an unprecedented economic catastrophe.
And at the time of that economic catastrophe, Hoover, as president, did precious little, but rather he just asserted that there are times of boom and times of bust, and we're just going through a cycle and it will all straighten itself out. Was he saying that essentially on the advice of his Secretary of the Treasury?
Well, Mellon, who was a creature of the 19th century, certainly believed that all booms ended sooner or later and that all slumps ended sooner or later, and that the capitalist process was therefore in some senses intrinsically self-regulating, that you shouldn't interfere with it, that you couldn't interfere mm-hmm. with it, and it would all sort itself out if you just hung in there for long enough. Hoover was slightly more interventionist than that and did think one or two things ought to be done, which Mellon on the whole didn't approve of. And of course, Roosevelt was later a great deal more interventionist than that. I mean, I think the comparison between Roosevelt and Mellon is interesting. Both of them wanted capitalism to survive. They agreed on ends, but they disagreed on means. Mellon thought if you just left it alone, it would all be okay. Roosevelt's view in 1932-33 was you just can't leave it alone. There are millions unemployed, ruined. The government's got to be seen to be trying to do something.
And Roosevelt, running for the presidency for the first time, needed to point at some villains who were partly responsible for all of this, and Mellon was one of them.
Mellon is right at the top of the list. Roosevelt borrows the phrase of his kinsman Theodore Roosevelt, malefactors of great wealth. And Mellon is the person he more than any other has in his sight for that. And Mellon is, of course, the person that the Roosevelt administration goes for in a big way from 32-33 on.
And at that time, Mellon has finally exited the Treasury Department, and he is our ambassador to the Court of St. James.
Mellon leaves the Treasury in March 1932, partly to escape a move to impeach him, prompted by a man called Wright Patman in the House of Representatives. Hoover is beleaguered. That's another problem, too many, that he doesn't want. Mellon goes off to be American ambassador to Britain from March 32 through FDR's election in November 32 to March 33, when FDR is inaugurated and Mellon comes back to America. And that's his last public job.
And the great surprise he comes back to is that he's brought up on tax evasion charges.
Mellon comes back having, as he feels, retired from an honourable public career and also by now having retired from business, determined to devote himself to the last great scheme and enterprise of his life, which he's been nurturing since 1927 or 8, which is the creation of a National Gallery in Washington. And that's what he now intends to do. Instead of being able to get on with that, he now finds that he's charged by the New Deal administration with tax evasion on a massive scale. And from 1933 to the middle of 1936, he's spending his time fighting that charge.
Was there anything to the charge?
I don't think there was anything to the charge that Mellon evaded paying his taxes. Mellon was scrupulously proper in paying taxes, right, federal taxes, right the way through the 1920s. What I think is going on more deeply is as follows, that during the 1920s, Mellon had certainly broken other rules. As Secretary of the Treasury, he wasn't supposed to be involved in business, and he was supposed to have sold all his bank stock. Well, Mellon conveys his bank stock to his brother, and he resigns his directorships, but it's absolutely clear that throughout the 1920s, he's still closely involved in major strategic decisions concerning the running of his companies, and he's closely involved with his brother Dick in Pittsburgh.
The way they handle that these days, if a very rich person with many such corporate involvements takes a cabinet position, is that you set up a so-called blind trust.
That's right.
Somebody else manages it, yeah, and you don't know what's going on with
that's
the
right.
money.
That didn't happen then. Mellon constantly denied that he was involved in business. He kept saying, I resigned from my business involvement as if I had died. But it wasn't true. And the Democrats know it's not true, but they never get him. And I think the tax evasion trial, rather like prosecuting Al Capone for tax evasion, was a way of hoping to get somebody, even not necessarily for the thing you wanted to do. The problem was that unlike Al Capone, Mellon really did pay his taxes.
Was this prosecution undertaken directly on Roosevelt's order, do you think?
Well, it was a colluded prosecution, if I can put it that way, between the Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, the Attorney General, Homer Cummings, and Roosevelt. Roosevelt certainly knew, and Roosevelt certainly encouraged it. But interestingly, the permanent officials in both the Treasury and the Department of Justice said, you're never going to be able to prove this. Mm-hmm. Trying to prove that Mellon is seeking to defraud the U.S. government of money isn't going to be possible. And in the end, it wasn't.
And during all this time, Mellon is still collecting pictures and forming plans and commissioning architects to build his great gift to the nation, namely the National Gallery.
That's right. From 1927 to 28 on, Mellon conceives this scheme, urged on, I think, by Juveen, that he ought to create a great National Gallery in Washington, that he would produce the money to pay for the building, money to provide an endowment, and his own pictures as the nucleus to get it started.
It's a wonderful story in your book that I'd never encountered before about the connection between Mellon and Joseph Stalin. And when we return from some impending commercials, we might talk about that. It relates to the building of the great collection. We return directly to David Cannadine after this. Then we come back to David Cannadine. And what's the connection between Andrew Mellon and Joseph, what was his proper name? Vissarionovich, I forget his last name.
But Stalin.
The fellow who became Stalin.
Stalin, we're after, yes.
Well, Djugashvili. Josef Vissarionovich Djugashvili, otherwise known as Stalin.
Otherwise known as Stalin. The connection is that between the spring of 1930 and the spring of 1931, Andrew Mellon bought 21 pictures from the Hermitage, arguably its greatest paintings, most of its greatest paintings, for about $7 million. The Russians were desperate for foreign Western European currency at that point. Stalin's about to collectivize agriculture and introduce his new economic policy for industry. But there's almost nothing in Russia to sell because the economy is in a bad way, except great works of art that Catherine the Great and her descendants have collected in the Hermitage. Mellon, by this point, wants to found his own great gallery in Washington. Here is a job lot, as it were, of great pictures from another gallery. And it's an opportunity he can't resist, even though, of course, Mellon hated communism. And even though at that point, the American government, of which Mellon himself was a member, did not officially recognize communist Russia at all. So it's an amazing kind of cloak and dagger story, really.
How many pictures were involved?
21 pictures.
21.
Including Raphael's, Raphael Madonna, Raphael's St. George at the Dragon, and a whole set of Rembrandts and Titians and the like.
The whole batch sold for a mere $7 million.
The whole batch sold for a mere $7 million.
Rather sounds like the deal. It's rather similar to what Thomas Jefferson pulled on Napoleon with regard to the Louisiana Purchase.
I think that's right. It's a sort of bargain of the century, really. It would be impossible, given that people now pay over $100 million for a single painting, it would be impossible to produce the contemporary equivalent of that. I mean, I think we would be talking billions of dollars if it was imaginable that such pictures could come on the market now.
He had an edifice complex at the end. He wanted to build that great National Gallery. He wanted a certain style of architecture. In fact, Roosevelt resisted that, but Mellon dominated with regard to the nature of the design, neoclassical design. He didn't live to see it, though, did he?
No, it's an astonishing story, the last phase of his life, that here is Mellon wanting to build his gallery and get on with it, and then he's held up for 3 years to cope with the tax trial. Then he finally gets back to the gallery in late 36 and early 37. But of course, the only way to get his gallery accepted is that Roosevelt, the man who has been going for him over tax evasion, has got to agree to it and to persuade a Democratic-controlled Congress to agree to it. In the end, all that goes through. Mellon carries off the scheme entirely according to his wishes.
Does all the money come from him? Or
all the money came from Mellon.
That's an incredible thing.
So that it was about $50 million. And that, in the end, was the great defense of the tax trial.
Yeah.
Why should a man who is contemplating giving the American people a gift of $50 million seek to defraud the U.S. Treasury of $2 million? That's ridiculous. And I think, in a sense, it was.
It was a great achievement. It is a glorious museum.
It is a wonderful building. I mean, it went through a phase when neoclassicism was unpopular, of being rather derided. But actually, it is, I think, an amazingly beautiful building.
And it has a great collection.
And the collection is fabulous. Yeah. But the collection, of course, is mainly not Mellon's. It's interesting that
It's grown since then.
Mellon's notion of the gallery was very much like Mellon's notion of business, that he started it off and then he hoped it would grow and hoped other people would contribute to it. And that was why he was determined not to call it the Mellon Gallery, because he thought if it was called the Mellon Gallery, other great collectors would not contribute, whereas if it was called the National Gallery, they would. And that turned out to be a very shrewd insight.
He dies at 82.
He died at 82 in August 1937, not living long enough either to witness his vindication on the charge of tax fraud or long enough to witness the opening and dedication of the National Gallery, which, of course, ironically occurs while Roosevelt is still president in March 1941.
Does he die at peace or is he a tortured person?
Hard to know. There were some who thought that by the end he did feel that his life had been unhappy and lived in vain. My instincts are that Mellon wasn't interested in those sort of metaphysical speculations, that he liked doing things, he liked accomplishing things, and took huge pleasure in the fact that despite the tax trial, he'd carried through the National Gallery deal and scheme, and that that was a marvellous thing to have accomplished even in his later years.
And he must have felt some gratification, given that he was so dedicated to business in its higher sense, and feeling that his social service was through the building of corporate enterprise and the further economic development of the country. He must have felt gratified that he had made a major contribution, quite apart from his contribution as Secretary of the Treasury.
I think that's right. Mellon's self-image was very much like his generational cohort, that he was a kind of industrial statesman, that building up the strength of the country was what people like him did, that they created jobs as a result, which meant that lots of people benefited. So I think Mellon felt that that had been a creative aspect of his life. I think he felt on the whole, certainly till 1929, that he'd been a successful Secretary of the Treasury. And I think he felt that the creation of the National Gallery was another very positive accomplishment for him from which the American people would benefit.
You are drawn, whether you are a Carlylean or not, you are in your work certainly drawn as your mentor, Trevelyan was, I would say, to great historical actors and their biographies as part of the history to be told. And we must pause right now, take care of some quick commercials. When we return, I put simply this question to you. Who are some of the other major figures that you've worked on or that you maybe think you will want to do some work on? You're still a very young fellow, only around 50, is it? Or
I'm not as close to 50 as you seem to think I am.
Mid-50s. Hmm. You've got a lot of work ahead of you still, and you are running a major institution in London, the Institute of Historical Research, which is affiliated with the University of London. Let's talk about some other great figures of modernity or just a few decades before the modern moment, and why they interest you and what might be said about how they turned history. We return to David Cannadine directly after this. While Andrew Mellon was Secretary of the Treasury, a man who filled the comparable post, Chancellor of the Exchequer, in Britain, was Winston Churchill.
Yes, it's a rather interesting coincidence that, since Churchill's somebody I have found an irresistibly captivating historical figure for as
long
as I've
been. Last time you were here,
historian.
We did a book.
We talked about exactly that.
About Churchill and the people of his time.
That's right. And Churchill was Chancellor of the Exchequer from 1924 to 1929. That's to say about half the length of time that Mellon was. But they were, for a period, overlapping and exact contemporaries.
We think we know what drove Andrew Mellon, a sense of duty and a kind of a Presbyterian accumulative conscience.
Yes.
What drove Winston Churchill?
I think a sense, and it's not quite clear where he got it from, a sense of destiny, a conviction that he was a different figure from most figures. He said to Violet Asquith, whom he first met in the 1900s, "We are all worms, but I do think I'm a glowworm." And I think he did have that sense of himself as being somebody special. a charismatic leader. He writes a novel in the late 19th century called Savonarola, which is about a heroic figure. And it's clearly Churchill dreaming about himself. And in the end, Churchill does become the hero he'd always dreamed of being. Also, I think Churchill was driven by the wish to prove his father wrong. His father, Lord Randolph, famously writes a letter, I think, in the 1880s or 1890s, saying, "You are a man of no abilities. You will never come to anything in life," which must rank as one of the most foolish parental predictions ever made. And I think he genuinely did wish to prove his father wrong.
And he's got the Demosthenes problem. He wants to be an orator, but he has trouble speaking.
That's right. He had.
And just like Demosthenes, he trains himself to be a great orator.
That's right. And Anar and Bevan would be another. He had a speech impediment somewhere between a lisp and a stammer and a stutter. And one of the reasons he ends up with these rather elaborate sentences and these long words was to avoid the treacherous rhythms of everyday speech. So that the mode of oratory and the apparent effortless fluency is in fact a way to get round the fact that he wasn't very fluent at all.
Shall we hear him right now rallying England? This is the famous "We shall fight them on the beaches" speech.
"We are told, sir, that Herr Hitler had a plan for invading the British Isles. This has often been thought of before. When Napoleon lay at Boulogne for a year with his flat-bottom boats and his grand army, he was told by someone, there are bitter weeds in England. There are certainly a great many more of them since the British Expeditionary Force returned. Sir, I have myself full confidence that if all do their duty, if nothing is neglected, and if the best arrangements are made, as they are being made, we should prove ourselves once more able to defend our island home, to ride out the storm of war, and to outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary, for years, if necessary, alone. At any rate, that is what we are going to try to do. That is the resolve of His Majesty's government, every man of them. That is the will of Parliament and the nation, the British Empire and the French Republic, linked together in their cause and in their need, will defend to the death their native soil, aiding each other like good comrades to the utmost of their strength. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old."
That's June 4th, 1940, in Parliament, I presume.
It's not the parliamentary speech, because Parliament wouldn't allow Churchill to broadcast beyond Parliament of the Nation, so Churchill had to record it again. And I think Harold Nicholson thought that the recorded version was nothing like as good as the original version delivered in Parliament. It is, of course, astonishing stuff. One couldn't imagine, I think, anybody speaking like that now. The accent is, of course, very different from the accents in which people speak today. The sentences are very long and convoluted, and you can actually catch, if you listen to that attentively, the occasionally slurred words where the speech impediment still comes out. But it's very ornate rhetoric of a sort which I think simply wouldn't work today. And of course, the other thing we have to remember is that it all still to this day leaves many of us moved, but that's only because it worked. I mean, suppose Hitler had won in 1940, this would all seem the preposterous rantings of a deluded, hallucinatory fool, whereas actually it all came out right.
And as you said earlier tonight, I think, Had he not been there, it might not have come out right.
Had he not been there, it might not have come out right. We still don't know, and I suppose we never will know, how important those speeches were, but the people who can remember them, and I don't think they are just making this up now, think they really did matter. I don't think anybody had ever delivered speeches like that on the wireless before to a nation in war. It hadn't been possible because the wireless hadn't existed. So that they were, in a sense, a wholly unprecedented phenomenon, the like of which I think will never happen again.
Shall we look upon his like again? Or is he a man of his period who couldn't possibly be duplicated in equivalent terms in modern time?
Well, Churchill was this very remarkable and in some ways lucky figure, though he would have also thought sad figure, who was a great Victorian figure born in 1874, whose life was mainly spent in the long run trying vainly to defend Britain's 19th century greatness. And he does say towards the end of his life, I have achieved a great deal to have achieved in the end nothing, notwithstanding winning the Second World War, was something that rather saddened him. So it would be hard to imagine in Britain nowadays anybody of Churchill's stature existing simply because Britain isn't such a great nation itself.
And the theme of Britain's decline and the decline of its aristocracy is one thing you've been much interested in and have written about in other volumes. We might talk about that some. Perhaps as a bridge to all of that, what you've got to say, as you have in print said a good deal, about the royal family across the generations, perhaps from Victoria and Albert down to the present moment. We return to David Cannadine right after an update on the evening's news as we go to Steve Ruxton. And we return to David Cannadine. We have gone, wandered perhaps, or at least we've traversed the circuit from Andrew Mellon to Winston Churchill. And then that brings to mind the British royal family, about which you've written a great deal. And, of course, the meaning of British royalty has changed, and I suppose the performance of British royalty has changed from the time of Victoria to the present moment.
Yes, I think when Victoria was queen, especially by the end of her reign, she saw herself as this grand imperial figure, the matriarch of a global empire on which the sun never set, and I suppose the upholder of stern Victorian values. Whereas in the course of the 20th century, in many ways, Britain has become a de-Victorianized nation in terms of its empire, its navy, its morality, its adherence or declining adherence to religion. And to a certain extent, the monarchy has become a de-Victorianized monarchy. Not, I think, in the shape of the present queen, who is herself in some ways a Victorian figure, but certainly in the shape of her children and her grandchildren.
I should think that the de-Victorianization of the British monarchy began with the son of Queen Victoria. Edward VII.
Well, Edward VII wasn't a very Victorian figure in a way, and of course his eldest son, Edward VIII, certainly wasn't a Victorian figure. So I suppose there have been, as it were, de-Victorianizing blips in the 1900s and the 1930s, but George V and George VI and the present Queen belong to a very different strand, I think, where public duty, morality, many of the things that Victoria believed in were their own watchwords.
The royal family has almost turned into a soap opera cast in recent years, if we think of the saga of Princess Diana and of her sometime husband, Prince Charles.
Yes, that's right. I think that since the 1960s, probably, deference has lessened. The media has become more intrusive. We live in a global world where celebrity is much more a global thing than it used to be.
But of course, thinking of soap opera, the real soap opera begins with Edward and Wallace Simpson, I suppose.
Yes, it's not as if Charles and Diana was the first such episode, even in the 20th century. Edward VIII and Wallace Simpson certainly caused the throne to tremble a bit. But of course, until very late on, that affair was entirely kept out of the British newspapers. It was in the American newspapers, but not the British newspapers. And on the whole, Edward went fairly quickly and fairly quietly.
So most of Britain was surprised when Edward gave his abdication speech?
Most of Britain was surprised in 2 or 3 weeks before when it was announced that he had a liaison with Mrs. Simpson. Most people in Britain did not know that because at that point American newspapers didn't make it to Britain and most people simply didn't know because the press had voluntarily kept quiet.
By the way, one has heard that that famous abdication speech, the speech about the woman I love, was written by Winston Churchill. Is that true?
I think Churchill had a hand in it, and it's certainly possible to detect some familiar Churchillian cadences, especially that sentence about, I have found it impossible to carry on the burdens of office without the help and support of the woman I love. I think that is quite possible. Churchill was a great supporter of Edward VIII. Not, I think, on the whole, a very wise decision on his part. George VI, who followed Edward VIII, and his wife, Queen Elizabeth, distrusted Churchill in 1940 when he became Prime Minister, in part because of his earlier support of Edward VIII.
Really? Of course, they were also quite distant to Edward VIII, who was now, what was his?
Duke of Windsor.
Duke of Windsor, exactly.
Yeah.
So they shuffled him off during the war to, was it to Jamaica or the Bahamas?
He was governor of the Bahamas, which was a way of getting him out of trouble. This was a not unreasonable thing to do because he'd been to Germany after he'd abdicated. There were all sorts of rumours of plots that if the Germans had successfully invaded Britain, Edward VIII would have been installed as a puppet ruler. How true those plots were, nobody knows really, but the rumours were rife, and so Churchill took the view that Edward had to be got as far away from Britain as possible.
Many years ago, Jessica Mitford, one of those Mitford girls, did a book about her life, her happy life in the Communist Party in California. I mentioned her on a new, she did that memoir, and we had her on this program. As I say, it was many years ago. Just now published, and I've just been looking at it this week, are the letters of Jessica Mitford, in which, among other things, she talks about her sister, Unity Mitford, who was virtually an intimate, so to speak, of Adolf Hitler. And that brings her around to the whole Clivedon set, as it's called, who were sort of Nazi enthusiasts in the British aristocracy.
Well, it's certainly true that in the 1930s, quite a lot of British aristocrats were enthusiasts for Hitler. They liked the smack of firm government, which they thought Hitler provided. They were worried about democracy getting out of hand in Britain, and they were worried about communism. And they saw Hitler and Mussolini as the best antidote to that. The Mitfords are, of course, hugely interesting. They were this family of remarkable women who went to all ends of the political spectrum. That's to say that Unity was an admirer of Hitler's. Diana married Oswald Mosley, and at the other end...
Mosley was the head of the British Union of Fascists, wasn't it?
And Jessica was at the other end. Interestingly enough, I met her towards the end of her life. She was going to write an article, in fact, about a book I'd written that had ruffled some feathers. And we had lunch in the Connaught Hotel in London. And, of course, by then, we're talking here the mid-1990s, she'd left Britain the best part of half a century. And yet we walked into this hotel and she simply took over the room and just commanded the place. And the waiters adored her and grovelled at her feet. She had an amazing capacity to consume alcohol. And it was as if she was presiding in a great house all over again. It was the most remarkable performance, which I've never forgotten. And she was very winning. She was very winning.
She was rather a charming woman, I remember.
She was charming and clever. And the causes that she backed were not always foolish. On the contrary, some of them were rather sensible. She wrote that famous book, The American Way of Death, of course, exposing the absurdities of the mortician's industry.
The other sister was Nancy Mitford, who became a very significant novelist.
Nancy became a very significant novelist and wrote one or two very splendid pieces, The Pursuit of Love, Love in a Cold Climate. And actually, if you read it carefully, you can work out who most of the characters were. And she, of course, was vaguely to the left of centre. So there was Nancy and Jessica on that side of things, and there was Unity on the other side, along with Diana. And then in the middle came Debo, the last surviving sister, who married the Duke of Devonshire and is now the Dowager Duchess of Devonshire, and was, I think, the only one of the sisters who was actually on speaking terms with all the others.
In the few minutes we've got before we go to commercials and then to the phones, and let me therefore quickly and parenthetically say that the phone number is, as ever, 591-7200, 591-7200. The lines are open and available to you if you want to pose a question about anything relating to modern history, but surely about Andrew Mellon or about Winston Churchill or about the state of Britain these days. Do give us a call, 591-7200. But in those few minutes, I do want to come to the state of Britain, both politically and in terms of its general social order or disorder. One gets a sense from over here that in many ways Britain has become a rather unmanageable place.
Well, I think as long as I've been coming to America since the 1970s, Americans have thought Britain an unmanageable place, and it seems to have been managing to unmanage itself the best part of 30 or 40 years. I think what's interesting about Britain at the moment is that it actually has an extremely prosperous economy. Although Britannia no longer rules the waves, and although it no longer has a great empire, and in that sense it's undeniably declined from the halcyon days, as we might say, of Queen Victoria, it has a very strong economy. One of the strongest in the world still. And there are those who claim, and I think not wholly wrongly, that it has managed a major change, especially the shift to a much more ethnically diverse society, with some degree of success, not total success, but some degree of success.
You don't worry then terribly about the threat of the Muslim threat from within?
Well, I don't see it as a threat. I see it as a problem to be addressed, which I think is being worked on. And I would hope that with luck it will be solved. But I think that these issues inevitably take a lot of time. I worry, I think, about faith schools, which I'm not sure is an altogether good idea, since if the idea is that people should be in some sense integrated, I think faith schools are going to get in the way of that.
By faith schools, you mean Islamic schools which teach not only the Quran, but the desirability of Sharia as a way of ruling Britain.
I think that's right. And it seems to me that to create schools where that sort of thing is promoted is probably not a good idea. So I do worry a little about that. But there are various interesting statistics. London is now the world's most multicultural city if you take the number of foreign languages spoken. It's a more multicultural city than New York or Chicago or Los Angeles, which is mildly interesting and is something perhaps we wouldn't expect. And the figures for mixed-race marriage in Britain are actually quite high. I can't tell you what they are, but they are quite high. So by various criteria, one could say that multiculturalism is there and is happening and is working. There are separate issues about how Blair is doing as Prime Minister, but that's slightly different.
One thing I'm aware of is what I think the journalists sometimes call yob culture.
I think it is certainly true that there are many towns in Britain where on a Friday or a Saturday night you might not be altogether well advised to go on your own. Consumption of alcohol among young people is very high, and antisocial behaviour on the basis of that is very high. Whether it's higher or lower than elsewhere in Europe, I have to say I don't know.
But it's higher than it used to be in Britain, surely.
I think it is probably higher than it used to be, and my instincts would be, though I don't know the figures, that it's higher than in America. That's certainly true. And one can make the argument that the reason for this is that in the old days, these were the people who would have been out there running the empire, but now they have nothing to do. That's not an argument for saying that we should have the empire back, but it is an argument for saying that there's a huge amount of youthful energy and self-indulgence, which in earlier eras was expressed.
They would have stood on
ways.
Kipling's Thin Red Line, wouldn't
that's
they?
Right.
And now all they could do is go to the pub and scream about football.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that's the whole story, but I think it is.
But it's a fascinating point. And our guest tonight is David Cannadine, noted British historian and biographer. He is a professor of history and director of the Institute of Historical Research at the University of London. His previous books, quite apart from the one that we've been talking about tonight, Mellon, An American Life, include, among others, In Churchill's Shadow, Confronting the Past in Modern Britain, The Decline and Fall of the British Aristocracy, and G.M. Trevelyan, A Life in History. Trevelyan was a great historian, and he was one of your mentors, was he not?
No, he wasn't one of my mentors. He died before I became of, as it were, historical age. But one of his proteges, J.H.
Plum,
one of my mentors. Quite so right. I wouldn't want to claim an apostolic succession, but there is a connection.
There's a laying on of hands.
There's a laying on of hands.
Right. 591-7200, the number. Some lines are available. If you've been trying to reach us, make another try, because we've cleared a few lines. And here is the first. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
My question has to do with how the monarchy, how a modern monarchy actually functions, and specifically, what are the limits of monarchical power in terms of politics and policy making at the beginning of the 20th century, and then how that compares to how and if it even functions in those realms today.
Well, the belief is that the British monarchy is a constitutional monarchy. That's quite a hard thing to get one's mind around, because Britain doesn't have a written constitution, so it's not quite clear where we go from there. But the rule book, to the extent that there is one, is that the British monarch has three rights: to warn, to encourage, and to be consulted. That's vis-a-vis the Prime Minister. Now, these rights were in fact invented by a journalist named Walter Bagehot in the 1860s and have become the kind of totemic articles of behaviour since then. Though it's fair to say that when Queen Victoria was on the throne, which was when Walter Bagehot was writing, she certainly thought she had far stronger rights than just to do that. So in a way, the monarchy has, I think, got weaker as we move from the 19th to the 20th century, as the polity has become more democratic and as party politics has become more dominant. So the position now is that the Prime Minister is essentially chosen either by the electorate at a general election or by the political party if the Prime Minister resigns during the course of a parliament. But the Prime Minister has an audience with the Queen every week. We have never known what goes on at those audiences because no records are kept and nobody ever says. But I should have thought by now the Queen has probably got a considerable reservoir of experience, and what advice she's given to Tony Blair we don't know. Whether he's taken it or not, we don't know.
And it's my understanding that the current monarchy does all that it can to stay apolitical. Is that true?
Well, that's certainly true in the sense that the Queen herself never ever ventures political opinions in public, and I don't suppose she does so in private either. Prince Charles, of course, has ventured fairly strong and definite opinions on things like global warming and architecture, and some people think he overdoes that. But certainly the Queen herself has never done so, and her mother, the Queen Mother, I think having given one interview early in her life, after that never gave interviews ever again. And there is an argument, which is often put in the case of Prince Charles, that actually one of the most important things for the royal family to do is not to speak in public at all, that they should just shut up.
Well, she must give her son some rather severe lectures on trying to correct his public performance.
Well, we cannot know, or at least there may be those who know, but I certainly don't.
You remember the wonderful, our thanks to the quality, remember the wonderful cartoon that Beerbohm did of Edward on his rare visits to Windsor to see his mother, Victoria. And the cartoon is Edward standing in the corner with his head to the corner, being punished by his mother for, I guess, his behavior beyond Windsor.
Well, I think it's certainly true that Victoria rather disapproved of her son Edward, and she rather hoped at one stage that he would never succeed her. And, of course, he was, in fact, only king for 10 years. And there are those who claim that the present queen takes the same view of her son. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But there are certainly those who do think that she thinks that the longer she reigns and the shorter he reigns, the better it will be.
Time for another quick round of messages, and then we shall return to David Cannadine and to your calls and email to him. 591-7200, the number. You are next on the air. Good evening.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. I have a question about some of those Churchill speeches he gave on the radio that some people say that they weren't given by Churchill, but rather by an actor who sounded like Churchill. Is that just fabrication or any truth in that?
This was a subject that caused considerable interest about 10 or 15 years ago in Britain, and it was, as you say, claimed that some of the great speeches declaimed on the radio were in fact declaimed by an actor. But the matter has been looked into, and as far as I'm aware, the evidence is conclusive that Churchill did in fact record them himself.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Why would such a rumour develop, I wonder?
Well, I think the idea was, which wasn't untrue, that Churchill was an extremely busy man at that time. 1940 was a rather eventful year, and there was a lot going on. And some of these speeches were actually quite long, and that by the time he'd done them once in the House of Commons, he had lots of other things to be doing, and that there really wasn't time for him to do them again. And I suppose also because there was this sense that these speeches had a particular iconic and historic status and significance, and that wouldn't it be odd if it turned out that he hadn't actually given them at all, at least in their popular form, whereas I think it did turn out that in fact he had.
It's another variant on the eternal conspiracy or they're hiding things from us kind of theme, isn't it?
Yes, it is a bit.
Pops up in every way.
Yeah, but it turned out that Churchill's voice wasn't Churchill's voice at all. But as I say, I don't think in fact that's true.
Another Churchill question, this one by email. Does Churchill count as a Victorian figure? And tell us about his young American mistress. Who are they referring to there?
I've no idea. No idea at all. Churchill, I think, certainly was a Victorian figure. He once said that when he delivered a broadcast on the death of George VI, it ends, I think, with the phrase, "I, whose youth was nurtured in the august, unchallenged, tranquil glow of the Victorian era, may well feel a thrill in invoking once more the prayer and the anthem, God save the Queen." So Churchill was a Victorian. The first 25 years of his life were lived under Queen Victoria's reign. And I think in some senses he felt his life had come full circle in that he saw in Queen Elizabeth II, and he did have this notion that he was playing to the young Queen Elizabeth II the same sort of mentoring role that Lord Melbourne had to the young Queen Victoria back in the late 1830s.
Was he capable of sitting at table after dinner and saying quite simply and directly, "Please pass the cognac"? Or did he have a rounder way of doing that?
Well, I think he might have done. He certainly enjoyed drinking brandy, of course. There's a famous story of Churchill inviting lots of Mormons to lunch at Chartwell in the 1920s, and the Mormons attack their orange juice and sparkling water, and Churchill, of course, attacks his brandy and champagne. And the chief Mormon is supposed to have turned to Churchill and said, "Mr. Churchill, the reason I do not consume alcohol is because it combines the kick of the antelope with the bite of the viper." And Churchill is supposed to have turned to him and fixed him with a beatifically wicked smile and replied, "All my life I have been searching for a drink like that."
Another great comment on his alcoholism or his rich investment in alcohol was, I forget who, was it Bessie Braddock, was that her name, in Parliament, who says, "Winston, you're drunk"?
It's Nancy Astor.
Oh, it's Nancy Astor herself.
Well, there are two Nancy Astor stories. One is Nancy Astor saying, "Mr. Churchill, you're drunk," and he replies, "And you, madam, are ugly, but I shall be sober in the morning,"
right,
which is not thought very highly of in politically correct circles these days. The other one is her saying to him, "If I were married to you, I would put poison in your coffee," to which he replies, "And if I were married to you, I would drink it."
Yes. Back to the phones, 591-7200. Good evening, you're on the air.
Yeah, my question is exactly what you're just talking about. I've heard many stories and read about how much alcohol Winston Churchill consumed, and by our standards, would he be considered an alcoholic? That's my only question.
Well, Churchill grew up in a world before the First World War where many politicians drank large quantities. Asquith, who was Prime Minister from 1908 to 1916, visibly swayed when attempting to stand up in the Commons, and it was generally said of him that he was more lucid drunk than most other MPs were when they were sober. But drinking was a widespread habit among public figures before the First World War. Churchill's drinking, I think, is quite a complicated issue. I mean, I think he did drink, as it were, every day, and so if that's a definition of being an alcoholic, I don't think there's any doubt that he was. But although there was quite a lot of brandy and champagne at lunch and at dinner, I think he always controlled his input. I mean, it is important to remember that Churchill worked incredibly hard all his life. And for Churchill, I think good living was not the denial of public duty and hard work. It was the essential precondition for public duty and hard work. And so the relation between Churchill's intake of both food and alcohol and his output in terms of words and work is quite an interesting and significant one.
Okay. Thank you.
We thank you, sir. 591-7200, if you've been trying to reach us, make another try. A few lines are cleared, and here is the next caller. Good evening.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
At the beginning of Hoover's memoirs, he says that when he took office, he was very surprised and appalled that to find the condition of the banks and the country, of course, at that time, by repute, was still at the height of rapid prospering and so forth. But he says that the succession states, the republics were established after the First World War over there, had been borrowing heavily from the major banks, the money center banks, such as in London and New York, and that it was starting to become apparent that that debt was probably not going to be any good, and that this was it appears that this was more or less a basic problem that's not much referred to as to the business collapse that happened about 8 or 9 months after he took office, and anyway the stock market collapse was about then, and then business in general dwindled away because for one thing banks there was little bank credit and banks needed to call in their loans. And that it seems to me that this was definitely Mr. Mellon's, he was Secretary of the Treasury for the preceding 8 years. And what that's part of his job under the Federal Reserve System is to more or less keep a weather eye on such things. And did he actually warn, for example, Mr. Coolidge of this developing very serious hazard?
Well, Mellon was, of course, himself by profession a banker. That's how he had got his start in life.
Well, yes, and why I'm thinking is that maybe his bank was perhaps one of those that's involved, and perhaps he did not, because it appears that, in other words, that obviously, since they were allowed to carry on their books, a rule is that they're allowed to carry at full value on their books a loan that is performing, unless there's some reason to believe that it's impaired. And as long as it continues to pay its required requirements, the payments required and so forth, they're allowed to carry that at full value. But it seems that it was becoming apparent that this was not actually, this debt was not good, and particularly they had been performing these loans by simply borrowing additional money from the same banks, which is considered practice that's well known to bankers, and it's considered nowadays a very bad practice, an alarming one, because naturally you can let somebody run on forever that way, and even a loan that's very bad. And was Mr. Mellon's personal involvement, of course, in his bank, which is where his main fortune was. Did that perhaps color his willingness to warn the administration he served about this horrible developing problem?
Well, there are a whole set of rather complicated issues there, one of which is Wall Street speculation, which, of course, crashes in October 1929. Mellon was certainly worried about that from the spring of 1929 and pushes quite hard to try to persuade the Federal Reserve Board, of which he was chairman, to increase interest rates in the hope that that will dampen speculation down. There wasn't much else Mellon could do. I mean, one of his problems as Secretary of the Treasury was that he actually didn't have much power to influence in general the way the economy was operating. Beyond that, of course, it was the case historically that the American banking system was very diverse and very unregulated. And it's not until Roosevelt puts in much more stringent legislation, beefing up the Federal Reserve Board in the 1930s, that America really has anything in the modern world approaching a central bank or guaranteeing bank deposits. So the American banking system was very vulnerable to international pressure, to runs on deposits. And of course, there is a huge cumulative meltdown of the American banking system from 1931 through to March 1933 when FDR takes over. How far Mellon, as himself a banker by profession, could or should have done more to alleviate that is, I think, a rather important issue. And there's certainly a big row in Pittsburgh because the Bank of Pittsburgh, which is the Mellon's great rival bank, does indeed go under in the early 1930s. And it was claimed, I think, and there is some evidence in support of this, that Mellon could have helped bail that out. But actually, he sees the demise of the Bank of Pittsburgh as a great opportunity to strengthen the position of the Mellon Bank itself in Pittsburgh. And many Pittsburghers never forgave Mellon for what they regarded as his part in that financial disaster, which wiped out the savings of many ordinary people.
Well, what I'm saying, though, it seems to me, I thought that even in those days, quite a bit of the responsibility of the Department of the Treasury was through the Office of Comptroller of the Currency, which I think is an appointive office, is it not? That they, the quality of the credits that the banks have is evaluated. And the Federal Reserve System was fully in place then. It had been since 1913, is it? And that it seems to me that this was, this is considered by many to have been a major part of the business collapse of the early 1930s, that the banks were in important respects actually insolvent, but they hadn't been their losses hadn't been recognized, and that the losses they had on the credit extended to the successor states over there was about the major thing before the business collapse.
Sir, I fear we must go to commercials in just a moment. Let's get some further response from David Canada.
Well, I've already made the point that the problem is that the Federal Reserve System as set up in 1913 isn't actually very strong. Bank deposits are not guaranteed by the United States government until Roosevelt comes in. And one of the difficulties is that many banks in America through the 1920s and early 1930s are very small scale, and they are very vulnerable when depositors lose confidence and withdraw their money.
And we thank you for a very interesting contribution. Some commercials await. Here they are. 591-7200 is our number, and you are the next caller. Good evening.
Good evening, gentlemen. I have a quick comment and suggestion on Mellon. I think, I believe his son, Paul, was more interesting than the original Mellon because he really shunned his father's businesses and was a prime developer of the National Gallery. I think one of the galleries there named the Mellon Gallery, and developed one of the great stables in American racing. Rokeby Stables is as big as Calumet, and I was just interested in your comment on that.
Paul's relation with his father was very complicated, and the relative standing of the two men in part depends on, you know, what weight you give to what they each chose to think of the more important thing to do. Andrew believed in accumulating money. He was passionately excited by business to the extent that he was passionately excited by anything. And late in life, he became a great art collector and a great philanthropist. He wanted Paul to follow him in the bank and in the businesses in Pittsburgh. Paul didn't want to do that,
right.
And Andrew made it pretty plain to Paul that he was disappointed in his son for not wanting to do that. I think it took Paul a long time to come to terms with the fact that he had disappointed his father, and to come to terms with the fact that on his father's death in 1937 he became a very rich man. But I do agree that in the long run, I think Paul made for himself a balanced, admirable, and happy life. as a philanthropist, as a great art collector, and as a breeder of horses, as you mentioned. And I interviewed him about five times in his house in New York and his house in Washington and on his farm in Virginia about his father. And I have to say, I thought he was an immensely interesting and charming and agreeable man. And there is his autobiography, Reflections in a Silver Spoon. And if you read between the lines of that very charming and urbane book, I think you do get a sense of the fact that it was really quite hard for Paul, and it took him a long time, till his late 40s, early 50s almost, to discover a life for himself which was fulfilling and happy and agreeable. But I think in the end he did get there. But I think many lesser men would simply have gone to ruin, and I think it was greatly to Paul's credit that he didn't.
I have one other quick question. Do you believe that Churchill was the most important and influential man of the 20th century?
I'm not sure he was the most influential. I think he was certainly one of the greatest men of the 20th century, and I think that's a verdict which is likely to stand. I think in terms of influence, I suppose one might want to make the argument that Stalin and Mao Zedong and Hitler may have had more. But Churchill was certainly a very great man. There isn't any doubt of that.
Well, thank you, sir, for the call.
Thank you.
And to another, you are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, sir. Good evening. But another one about Churchill here. I'm in reading his books on the Second World War. I'm actually on the, on the third book right now. And coming out of this, and so he's written them himself, about his leadership, a couple of questions about that. One about his leadership ability. Was he really as nice to people as it comes out in the book? Other than one case near so far out of the second book where he doesn't seem to be very nice, very happy with someone. The second thing is he just seems to be so totally involved in everything. You know, I realize it's a war and all that, but it's still so totally involved in everything and just has his finger in everything that's happening there. And then the third thing, the feeling of his staff, because he had a daily nap. And did they enjoy that or appreciate that, or did they have anything to say about that?
Well, Churchill's History of the Second World War is one of the most remarkable literary constructions of the 20th century. It's six volumes. It sold millions of copies when it came out, and it really influenced and set the general view of what the Second World War had been about for one or even two generations. And of course, there's no other major leader who produces a history of the Second World War. Stalin didn't, Hitler self-evidently couldn't, Mussolini couldn't, and nor could Roosevelt. And the only thing that comes close is De Gaulle's memoirs, and they were not really in the same league because France's role in the Second World War was very different. So it is a wholly remarkable book, or they are a wholly remarkable group of books.
Mm-hmm.
And a colleague of mine called David Reynolds has written a wonderful book about how Churchill wrote the history of the Second World War. I mean, on the points that you actually raised, was Churchill as nice a man as he appears? Well, he certainly comes across in his memoirs as a magnanimous man. There are enemies or people he doesn't like. Field Marshal Wavell is one of them, and that may be the man you've just come across. I mean, Churchill isn't afraid to sack his generals, and he isn't afraid to sack his ministers. And on the whole, if you're fighting a war, I think that's probably a capacity you need to have.
Mm-hmm.
Fighting war is not fun. Churchill was a great man. He wasn't always a nice man, I think. As far as Churchill's involvement in everything is concerned, of course, it's important to notice in Churchill's History of the Second World War that he prints his own memoranda, but he never prints the replies of other people.
Right.
So it is, to some degree, one-sided, and that's something I think it's quite important to be aware of. Churchill's staff, I think, two different things, really. I mean, all of them said that working with Churchill was the greatest experience of their lives, and they wouldn't have missed it for anything. But all of them also said in moments of fatigue and exasperation that he was absolutely impossible. And Field Marshal Allenbrook, who was chief of the Imperial General Staff, kept diaries in the Second World War, which captures very vividly both the sense of amazement and the sense of rage and exhaustion. Because while Churchill is having his nap in the afternoon, some of these people are up from, as it were, 5 in the morning till 4 in the morning and are just completely wiped out by trying to keep up with Churchill.
Mm-hmm.
So Churchill's history is still, in some ways, the most remarkable book on the Second World War, but it has to be read very carefully.
Oh, okay.
We thank you, sir. Glad for the that you called us. We've just got a few minutes left. I want to titillate you with, or maybe even confound you with, some quotations about your discipline, history itself. Ambrose Bierce, I guess I just want your reactions to these different views of history. Ambrose Bierce says, history, noun, an account, mostly false, of events mostly unimportant, which are brought by rulers mostly knaves and soldiers mostly fools.
I think that that's a not very helpful observation, really. But I suppose, I mean, who is it who says history first time round is tragedy, second time round is farce?
Karl Marx.
Maybe it's fairly close to that.
Yeah. Edward Gibbon, in The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Though maybe he says it in his memoir, I'm not sure. I have but one lamp by which my feet are guided, and that is the lamp of experience. I know no way of judging of the future but by the past.
Well, it's an argument that's often made, that history does provide some understanding of the future because of what's gone on in the past. I'm slightly skeptical of that, I have to say. It seems to me that all that history probably will tell you is the future won't work out the way you might think it might.
So the old saw of Santayana's, which is so often overquoted, isn't really that trustworthy either.
I think that's right, yeah.
Thucydides, the father of history, one might well say, unless you want to count Herodotus, history is philosophy teaching by example, is a well-known quotation.
It's a well-known quotation.
Is it true?
Well, sometimes yes, sometimes no, I think is the best quick answer I can produce to that.
What's been going on in your discipline, as it has in other related humanities disciplines for some years now, is a shift in style and really in attitude on the part of those who work the discipline. The new historicists and the postmodernists argue essentially history is a tool by the ruling class to oppress everybody else.
Yes, well, they seem to think that almost everything comes in that category, and I'm not sure I would sign up to that. I mean, I think a slightly different version of that point would be that we live in a world now where cultural history is thought to be an enormously important subject, which when I was growing up and in graduate school had really not been heard of. And what that means is there's been a shift in my lifetime among what historians think is important, from causes and explanation as to how and why things happen, to meaning and understanding, that is getting a sense that what people thought in early times is different from our own, and quite how we get from there to here isn't clear. And I think that certainly is a considerable shift in what the purpose and priorities of history are. But no doubt that in its turn will be overridden by something else. I mean, one of the things about history that's enormous fun is that what people think history is about, in terms of how you do it and what the subject matter of history is, constantly changes, and it keeps changing, and that seems to me all to the good.
So the great dictum that was once quoted as a guide to young aspirants to the historical profession, the dictum of Leopold von Ranke, tell everything the way it really happened. Alles erzählen, wie es eigentlich gewesen war, makes no sense.
Well, I think it does make sense. I think that historians do have an obligation to tell what they think it's possible to know, and what we think it's possible to know is what the archives and the sources tell us.
But there's so much else that surrounds the object that you fix your attention to, or the process, or the events that you fix your attention to. History is necessarily always, in the hands of the historian, is always an editing job, isn't it?
Yes, it's always an editing job, because there are some things we put in and some things we leave out, and it's always an interim job because more evidence may come up. Mm-hmm. But if I can rise to the supreme conceit of citing my own example, here we have 621 pages and several thousand footnotes on the life of Andrew Mellon. Well, it's not the authoritative life, but it's based on 78 archival sources. We now know, I think, a great deal more about Andrew Mellon than we did before, and while on occasions there are paragraphs of speculation, on the whole, this is an account based on the evidence of what it's possible to know about Andrew Mellon, and it seems to me, in the end, it's possible to know quite a lot.
We were talking before the program about another very significant modern British historian, Ian Kershaw, who did that splendid two-volume history of Adolf Hitler. It's a political history. You are an historian here doing a biography. That's, you'd probably do it differently than would a, quote, pure biographer, wouldn't you?
Yes, I think that's right. Ian's two-volume Life of Hitler is itself very instructive, because he has a rather elaborate and, I think, wholly convincing introduction where he says that one of the things historians ought to do, which biographers should do but often don't, is to get a sense of the limitations to what any individual, even Hitler, can actually accomplish, and to get a sense of the world in which they're operating and the background and constraints against which they operate. As it were, the Marxist line, people make their own history, but not in circumstances of their own choosing. And I think that it is right, as a historian writing a biography, that one should constantly remind oneself and remind the reader that people are not omnipotent, and that you need to understand the limits as to what is possible. And I think Ian does that brilliantly with Hitler. And in my own way, I've tried to do it here with Mellon.
Is there any other figure in sort of the range of modern history in which you've worked who attracts you as a potential biographical subject?
Well, nobody, oddly enough, in Britain has ever managed to produce a wholly convincing one-volume life of Lloyd George, and I don't know why that is. There have been lots of attempts, and it's never quite come off. And therefore, I don't think there's quite as much of a sense of Lloyd George's remarkable career and remarkable stature as perhaps there ought to be. And so maybe he'd be somebody who would be worth having a try at one of these days.